gentlemen, to this final hour of the Hagmann Report. Stan Deo is our guest, as he is each and every Tuesday. Folks, go to standeo.com, click on the show images page, and you can follow along what Stan has researched throughout the week and what he's going to be talking about on the show. We're going to go to Stan in just a second. I want to bring you a quick word from SolarC, one of our partners in this radio show. Some of the most overlooked preparations are water and energy. With the real threat of cyber attacks and EMP weapons, you may want to consider the SolarC. It is the only EMP-hardened battery-based solar system available to the public today. The folks at Portable Solar have designed this product with EMP hardening and expandability in mind. This is a veteran-owned Christian company, and they stand by their products. You can go to their EMP testing videos on their YouTube channel, or by going to their website, www.solarc.us. Most people don't realize how much power they need to run essential items, you know, the refrigerator, your freezer, your washing machine, lights, air conditioning in the summer. And Portable Solar engineers help you decide what type of backup power you should consider and how to pick a good system, even if it is not their product. If you want a free consultation, you want more education, materials, and to find out more about the product, go to solarc.us. That's www.solarc.us, or give them a call, 972-575-8875. That's solarc.us. All right. Stan Deo is our guest. Stan comes on every Tuesday, as we just said. I'm looking on the show images page. There's a whole bunch of stuff we're going to get into tonight. Stan, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back, guys. I had a little rain today, which was nice to cool off this 90-some-odd degree temperature we've had.
Yeah, there's been a significant heat wave throughout the Midwest and in the South. Not so much where we are. It's kind of fallen right under us a little bit. And, you know, we've been lacking rain a little bit the last few weeks. But, yeah, it's always good when you're in that type of heat to get that cool down.
Yeah, walking in the garden in the cool of the day, as the Bible says. You know, the weather, the climate, in essence, all over the planet is changing. There's no doubt about that. One of the things I put up on the show images page today at slide 42 is a link to a site that lets you check real-time what your UV exposure is in your town, in your area. You can also just see the global map there. If you click on it, you can see the map I took a snapshot of about 2 or 3 hours ago. And the kind of, I guess, purple, bluish purple haze. Are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, I'm getting some terrible feedback some reason or another. Are you hearing it on your side?
No. I just heard a little bit of a...
Yeah, when you said,
okay.
Are you...
Well, as long as it's not bothering you, I don't know what's causing that. But anyway, the map is showing the high levels of ultraviolet radiation across the United States primarily. I don't know whether this map, you know, if you go to the actual site, which you can do by clicking on the Be Alert text underneath that, it allows you to adjust, like, the scale of the map so you can see not only the United States but across the whole planet. There's an awful lot of ultraviolet radiation, primarily in the equatorial regions, but some of it's creeping up into the Midwest here. Now, what we're seeing is what's called 11-plus rating, which is not good.
I want to ask you about this, because I don't know if I'm losing my mind or if I was... This might be a stupid question. I thought the UV index only went up to 10. Am I wrong in that?
It used to a long time ago. Now then, they've pushed it to 11. And 11 plus, which means it could be anywhere, you know, 12, 13, or whatever. It's like some of the other records in, earthquake magnitudes where they've raised the bar a bit, if you wish, because we're being surprised by greater, stronger, more numerous events. In this case here, it is really something to pay attention to as far as being out in the sun. It is at a cancer-producing level if you're out too long, and this, at least this website shows you that if you're a skin type 1, 2, 3, or 4, how long you can stay out in the sun with the UV index, in our case here, at 11+. And this is going to get worse, in my opinion. The sun is going through a change, as I say, every week. It is going through a phase state change, which means doing things that scientists, physicists have not predicted it would do for millions of years, but I think it's starting to do something that will change the diameter of the sun and throw off a large cloud of debris for a period of time that will surround the sun and make it very kind of dark. Maybe like some of the predictions people are saying about the 3 days of darkness. Wow. Did you hear that?
I just heard it. We just heard like a quick, high-pitched hiccup almost.
Yeah. I don't know what's doing that, but it certainly, I'm just checking all my leads here to see what's happening. I don't see anything that's causing it. Anyway, pardon the interruption if it happens again. It might be solar wind or some kind of harmonic of that that's causing a communication problem here with my phone. I don't know. Anyway, go to this map daily if you're going to be out in the sun. My advice is to cover your arms and body and neck and head as best you can if you're going to be out over 15 minutes, because I think these things will get worse. And on that happy note, look at slide 35. Sorry,
if
go
I
on.
Can, if I can jump in real quick, it's strange to me because I remember being kids and teenager and all, you know, being outside all the time, never putting on sunscreen, never worrying about, you know, this kind of stuff. And even now, even in today's world, you know, going out and sitting by a pool or on the beach for a while, it's hard for me to fathom that people, that the sun is becoming so dangerous, I guess, is what the point of this is. Because, I mean, I've never seen in my life so many people complaining about how hot the sun is, people who are doing roofing jobs getting second-degree burns, you know, just from being up there. I've never seen this with the sun. And I guess, you know, people have made the argument that the sun used to be yellow, now it's white, and it's changing, whether it's our atmosphere or magnetosphere that's making it happen, or, you know, the chemicals in the ozone. Something's changing, apparently, because a lot of people are noticing it, both in physical effects and just by observation.
Yeah, it is more toward the white-bluish stage. And, you know, I had this confirmed by talking to the U.S. Air Force officer in charge of the monitoring of this when I was in Australia. And the major said that since 1992, there have been at least two new bandwidths in the ultraviolet range that have started coming out of the sun. And you might kind of yawn and say, okay, well, that's neat. I then contacted the Solar Observatory in Arizona and to the chief scientist there, and we exchanged letters and pictures and photographs and discussions about what he'd found. And the ultraviolet changes how various life forms, you know, microscopic life forms, breed in the ocean. And these increased frequencies that are appearing, more than just the two of 1992 and these bandwidths, these increased UV emissions, to me, indicate quite clearly, without a doubt, that the nuclear chemistry that makes the sun work is changing. Now, this is not a healthy thing at this point. I think we're going to see changes in the solar irradiance factor, you know, how much light it puts out in various bandwidths. And it's certainly already affecting our crops and our rainfall patterns. And they're going to try to continue to blame it, like Al Gore has, on human endeavors, human activity that creates greenhouse gases and holds the heat in. But this argument just cannot work as the primary cause of this global heating. This has happened before in history. You can drill down into ice cores in the Antarctic and see that we've had a spontaneous heating of the planet and increases of like carbon dioxide, but also the various hydrates, methane hydrates, things that release their gases before humans were even industrialized, a long time ago, before, you know, we were even walking very far across the planet of the Earth. So the argument is really kind of lame as far as blaming it on people and human industry. Look at slide 35. Now, this happened over the weekend, and Earthquake Kim, one of your listeners, and I exchanged quite a few emails back and forth about this.
I saw this.
Say again?
I saw this, Stan. I saw the video of this massive solar eruption on the far side of the sun, and remember thinking, if this were even, you know, 45 degrees the other way, especially 90 degrees, it would basically terminate any kind of electronics we ever had on Earth, and who knows what else it would do. This was a massive eruption.
I think just on a point of trigonometry there, if it was 180 degrees, in other words, coming at us instead of going away from us, that halo, or, you know, round kind of edge to it, it's called a halo of CME, that was going directly away from the Earth. If it had been around on this side, which that spot will be in less than 2 weeks, you know, probably about 12, 13 days, it will be in an Earth-directed position. And if it produces more of this kind of flares and CMEs, what you just suggested may well happen. We may have an interruption to a lot of our electronic processes. You know, depending upon how strong something like this is, it can fry with an EMP all of our electronics on the side of the planet that is facing that. You know, for a brief moment when this came across the monitoring we have for the solar event, I looked at that and I thought, holy cow, it's heading our way. What have we got? You know, what, 25 hours? I mean, I was starting to figure out what are we going to unplug and go to EMP safe until I could, you know, get it confirmed that it was definitely ejected away from the Earth. But this is something that is of concern, and seeing these kind of beautiful halo effects tells you when it's coming at you or directly away from you. So, folks, if you go to the slide 35 in the text portion, click underneath that, you can see the NASA discussion of this event and saying, well, okay, we missed a big one, but, you know, here's the potential. Anyway, that ties in with our UV slide up there, 42.
Well, Stan, are they able to, like, when we have Earth-directed CMEs and solar flares, they give it value, whether it's, you know, a C class, an X class. Are they able to determine values for flares that are on the opposite side of the sun?
To a degree, yes. They have a couple of, satellites, the stereo satellites, that one runs ahead of the spin of the sun, and one runs lags behind. So that in essence, they get imagery on the backside of the sun. And from that, I am pretty certain that they can estimate the X or, you know, M class or whatever class it is, value. They don't have to have it on the side facing us.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious to know if they assigned this one any value and what that was, if they had.
Okay, and I, again, for the second or third week, I guess, in a row, say look at slide 36. You don't have to do it immediately, but it's a FEMA report that's released under the Freedom of Information request that tells that FEMA is expecting solar EMP events that we need to be prepared for, and this is a paper that was an inter-department paper that tells them what they're expecting. So if they're telling their people inside to get prepared for this kind of event, and that was years ago, probably, what, 8-9 years ago they did this, we really need to be preparing ourselves to endure loss of power. And this is why, you know, my team, one of us, one of your listeners out there as well, a very good friend, why we're working on developing a way to get electricity from the solar wind, you know, coming out of the sun, hitting our atmosphere, which produces a lot of the electrical and magnetic effects that we see on the planet. We're looking at designing a device that not only gives you the power, but doesn't depend on semiconductors and things that can be damaged by an EMP pulse, whether it comes from the sun or a nuclear bomb. Our fear is that we've left our run too late, and this stuff is going to happen before we can get this stuff finished and out to people. We want to design something that's like a Model A Ford, where they had to get out in front with put a crank in the beginning of the engine, you know, at the front there, and give it a couple real fast twists to start the engine. But it was a mechanical way to start it, and we're looking at a similar way, at a device that we can mechanically start a transforming device that will take the electrical energy from the solar wind and give you electricity for quantities, you know, voltages, these are things we're playing with at the moment, trying to figure out the best way to do it. But certainly, you know, 600-volt supply coming out of the atmosphere and even out of some ground cables is possible. But we're trying to get a lot more so that people can power whole houses for, you know, long periods of time. This kind of energy does not go away until the sun stops producing solar wind. So we have energy from the sun in the daytime. And at night, it is about 25% less power available to us from this source. But not only that, I found that this solar wind thing that we're tying into actually drives what's called the telluric, that's T-E-L-L-U-R-I-C, the telluric currents in the earth underneath the dirt here. And during the day, on the day side of the planet, these currents, these electrical currents in the soil, run from the equator, I think it's from the equator during the day, toward the poles. And then at night, it reverses going from the poles to the equator. Now, I may have that direction reversed for the time of day, but basically what it's saying is when the sun is directly shining on the earth, it's producing these super electrical currents underneath the surface of the earth. Now, back in the, 1870s or so, when they started using telegraph systems across the United States, some of the operators found that they were getting kind of strange bursts of energy that would run several hours along the line. And they determined that if they take copper and steel plates, you know, probably 2 feet by 2 feet, and separate them for a few yards, drive them down into the dirt, into the wet dirt, and run wires from them, each of these plates, to, say, a device to measure the voltage, they were getting 1 volt of current out of the earth between these plates. And it wasn't just, thermochemical reactions. It was something down there. And they were actually tying into the flow of these telluric currents. And during the Carrington solar event, the coronal mass ejection, these currents were boosted so heavily that you know, it damaged a lot of the telegraph networks and made arcs come to ground and caught poles on fire and that kind of stuff. That tells us that there is a very direct and strong link between the solar wind and the telluric currents. Now they've also discovered that these currents flowing drive thunderstorms, that the thunderstorms tend to follow the current paths, depending on how strong they are underneath the earth. So these things tell us that the energy is there, and it is up to us to figure out better ways than they did back in the 19th century to convert this to usable household current and to make it safe. You know, we have got to design in things that for lightning strike and for super CMEs that raise the voltage on our antennas and stuff like that. But we are getting close. We are terribly excited about this.
And Stan, I think you would be one of the most familiar with the work Tesla did. Many people say that he was able to not only find, you know, the radio signals and expand that, but that the concept of free energy, something you've been working on, that was discovered by him, a long time ago, but was suppressed, for purposes of a number of reasons. Money being one of the most important, I think.
Yeah, I think this suppression is not only of his work, but work and patents and development and papers on electrostatic phenomena. Now, I noticed this in 1958. Now, it's been probably 20 years since I went to the library, but, you know, a physical library. But at the time, I looked at the number of papers, the volumes, you know, the indexes for papers written on magnetism, electricity, that kind of stuff. And that was separate from electrostatic phenomenon in the library. And in electrostatic phenomenon, before 1958, the width, if you wish, of the books or indices saying these are the papers written on electrostatics and these are the papers on magnetics and electricity, the width of these were roughly the same. A lot of research going on in all three of them. But in 1958, around May, I started noticing that the width of the indices on published papers in electrostatics just suddenly narrowed. I mean, it was not gradually, it just dropped almost gazilch, while everybody else's papers on magnetics and electricity and that kind of stuff, and radio propagation, all that expanded. You know, the indices grew wider and wider, you know, as far as the number of pages in them. Now, why? Because, in my opinion, someone in the structure of science found out that the electrostatic phenomenon offered a whole new world of devices and processes that we could develop. Now, this sounds conspiratorial, but I think that the planners, they were looking at a way to set up a new world order and wanted to fool the people of Earth into thinking new technologies had come from, you know, space, from Elder Brothers or whatever. They sequestered a lot, if not all, of the new developments in electrostatics in certain areas, particularly energy production and propulsion. But they sequestered that away from the public eye and developed it in our labs, like with the project I was on with Dr. Teller, which led to things like antigravity. But Tesla's work, he had one patent. I think Tesla's work was really good. One patent that survived shows, a mast, an antenna mast going up with a polished metal plate up on the top of it, and then down at the bottom of the mast, the current comes into a little spark gap, and a way to trap that electric charge into usable, you know, mechanical motion. Well, even in that patent, he described it as getting the energy of the sun collected on that plate and then converting it to electricity. Well, semiconductors like we use in all the solar collectors that people use on the roofs, these are an offshoot of what he was talking about, much more efficient than what he was talking about. But what they didn't, you know, allow to surface was his patents expanding on what he did there and ways to pump that antenna to get a lot more energy per square foot than he was getting in what he applied for in the patent. Anybody that's going to file a patent today even knows that you file a patent in general terms on what your thing kind of generally does, so that it locks it in that you've discovered this process by using this particular invention. But it doesn't give in your patent. You don't give too much away so that Smith down the street can go down here and build that version and then improve it and file another patent to swamp you. So that's the philosophy behind it. So even Tesla's attorneys may have said to him, don't put everything in there. I don't know. But we're getting there. I mean, we're picking up on his work. I've got a huge library of Tesla papers and writings, been through it many times, and have actually been privileged to read some of his correspondence and notes that he made in the Hotel New Yorker, which are locked up in the Tesla Museum in Belgrade to this day. And it's by nefarious means, we locked me in the room with all of his papers for over an hour to look at and read as many of these things as I could and look at photographs and, you know, plate glass negative contact pictures and stuff that he made that are kept there but not for public display. So I'm telling you, yeah, you're right. He was kind of the early inventor to make this practical for us, and now then, a number of us are trying to push that forward, and looks like successfully, to make it a viable proposition for the average homeowner with a little electrical knowledge to not only put the thing together but maintain it when we lose power.
What a discovery that would be to be
able
to.
Well, it is there. I mean, look, if you look down at slide 34,
whether it be third world nations, third world countries, and countries, underdeveloped countries, just the prospect of having, you know, energy that you don't have to plug into a grid or a main source, you know, company source to get, I think that would change the world.
It is going to be earth shaking, and we looked at these third world countries. And, you know, the shortage of water and power are two primary problems they've got. With the power, they can drill down to water in aquifers, deep ones, or whatever, or they can convert seawater to fresh water, or they can use atmospheric condensers to condense water out of the air. But with the power, they can do all these things and pull themselves up by the bootstraps and start to, you know, catch up with the rest of us and to have food and water every day. This is one of our objectives in this.
Yeah, and that's very promising to hear you talk about it, and just the fact that you're one of the people, you know, going over this research and trying to rediscover how that process works of just grabbing energy from the atmosphere. And I believe it can be done. We've seen some things, a year and a half ago, me and my dad were with a gentleman who showed us a way to a free energy concept is what it was, and it was fascinating to watch. But hopefully, go ahead.
Yeah, well, one of our team members up in Canada has actually, you know, played with an underground, like a buried cable that he was pulling up from a site he was demolishing. And he was able to get a spark, an arc, that was, you know, every time he'd press on, like, tack, tack, tack. We measured from his description of the length of the arc that it was between 600 and 1,000 volts. And it was there just constantly, bang, bang, bang. I talked to Art Bell years ago on his radio antenna for, you know, his ham radio thing. He sent me photos of it, and he was getting between 600 volts and 1,000 volts from his antenna straight to ground, and it was above ground. That is, you know, small potatoes, but it does tell us that the stuff is there, and if you lower kind of the resistance, I guess the easiest way, the resistance of the atmosphere, if you lower the impedance of it, you can cause energy, electrical energy, to flow into your antenna. And the more that you draw from it, the bigger the field becomes, and the more you can draw up to the hysteresis point of your antenna. So
that's fascinating. Yeah. Stan, we're right up against the break.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I want to pick up here when we come back, because this is fascinating stuff. Folks, you're listening to Stan Deo. StanDeo.com is the website. Check out the show images page. You can follow along with what we're talking about. We'll be right back with Stan after this break. Don't go anywhere.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
There shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Eric said.
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman and Hagman Report family. MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow. It's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
Hi, I'm Grace Gonzalez from Caring Close in the Woods. We are an American family-owned company founded and built on skills and knowledge gained from responding to 18 major disasters in the U.S. and around the world. We found that most people don't have enough food and water to survive, let alone any medicinals to save their life. We are offering 25% off our must-have American Heritage Armies kit. It contains 12 homeopathic remedies, a booklet that goes over everything in your kit, and our brand new book, Major Disasters Lessons Learned. Just enter coupon code HAGMAN. In life or a disaster, you must be able to take care of yourself. You may not be a medical doctor, and your grandmother and your great-grandmother probably weren't either, but they still knew how to minister to their family's health issues, and so can you. Check out our American Heritage Armies kit at www.changeclosenwoods.com. Your life may depend on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. That means you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman Report. Stan Deo is our guest. We were just before the break. We're going to continue where we left off. Stan, you were talking about Art Bell and the antenna he had on his shortwave
ham radio.
Okay, and the amount of voltage that was picking up, and the ability for it to even generate more than what it was picking up.
Yeah, well, basically, it's like I compare the process to like taking a gallon of gasoline that you need to siphon into your tank. And you can set that gallon of gasoline up on a little stool up a little bit higher than your car window there so that you can get the height. But you can put a siphon hose in it and stick it into your tank opening and stand there all day waiting for something to happen until you actually jiggle it a bit and cause some of the gasoline to go down the tube into your tank to a lower level, you know, from the surface of the earth. Until you do that, the stuff won't flow. But once you do that, then you can even open the diameter of your hose and more and more energy will come, or gasoline will come through the hose. Once you start the effect, you've got to trick it into starting. You've got to find a place for it to flow to from where it is. And it's obviously not going to flow to the gasoline tank or the container, the portable thing to go down there because the metal wall stopped that. But this is what I'm talking about. Once you lower the impedance or the resistance of the atmosphere around your antenna, there is a way to trick it, like a siphon, to start letting the energy flow into that antenna as though it were the greatest ground in the world. And the more that you pour into that antenna, up to the limit of the antenna's ability to handle, the more that you pour in, the bigger the volume of the field around it, which is sucking it in. So the more energy you draw, the more energy you can draw, up to the limit of your antenna parameters. And we've always known for 100 years or so at least, that there is a potential of 300 volts per meter, you know, say per yard roughly, from your feet to your head might be 600 volts charge difference, but it doesn't arc down your hands or into the floor from you, you know. That difference is not attainable because it's static. It's not moving. And this is what our whole approach is to get that moving. And once it does, it creates, in essence, a vacuum for energy like that to flow into till you reach the limit of your pipe or your tube, in essence, your antenna, so that it will just flow as long as the solar wind is hitting our atmosphere.
Okay.
You can see part of the design, we've now rejected this particular one, but in MH34, it's one of the parts of a new invention of a kind of motor that's not been invented before to utilize some of that energy in a way that we hopefully can manually control.
That's very interesting.
See some of the other stuff we're designing. I mean... it's been crazy, but anyway, yeah, we're cutting new ground on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. And if anybody can do it, Stan, I'd say you're the one who'd be able to figure this out.
Me and my team, they're a bunch of good guys. Each has their own contribution to what we're doing, and certainly I've got a very strong ally, one of your listeners that we've joined forces and met and discussed these things, and we just fit like hand in glove with the work that both of us are doing. So,
well, that,
I'm encouraged.
Fantastic.
Your Lord has your hand on it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Stan, moving forward to something we mentioned in the beginning of the show, show images number 41, the significant decline in sperm counts in the Western world by almost 50 to 60%.
Did you mention that in the show, did you?
Yeah, we mentioned it a little bit, and you know what's interesting about the study is the even though they weren't looking for the causes, they attributed it to the way we live, the chemicals that we ingest, whether in the air, the water, the food, or whatever, was one of their main areas of saying this is why this is happening.
Hmm. that that's entirely it, because the area is not affected so much at all by this. You know, we're South America, Africa, and Asia. Now, Asia, you know, talk about eating stuff. If you look at China and stuff, and Japan, the pollution from various other sources for decades has been such that it's a wonder that they don't come down with all kinds of diseases in these countries due to their diet. But that may not be the cause. If you look up above 41 at slide 44, I snapped just a while ago today the image of the carbon dioxide concentrations in the world. And what I did see was that certainly carbon dioxide production, you know, in South America, it's only about the top third of it that's affected by it. Africa has mainly none of that problem. But then I look at Asia, and it's got a lot of it. So I realize that even though this could be a contributing factor, you know, the carbon dioxide, less free oxygen radicals for people to breathe, that there is going to be something that we will probably find that will correlate these countries that are having the low sperm count. It may be due to, Asia. Yeah. I don't know. It may be due to too much sitting around, you know, in Europe and the United States, the Western world particularly. We sit around a lot more than we used to after World War II. And this may cause problems with the production of testosterone and with the, you know, the sperm in the guy, just simply because of the pressure of sitting a lot more. You know, it does create blood clots and other complications, the deep vein thrombosis syndrome. Maybe that's it. But whatever it is, it's a marked difference, and the Western world is going to probably not propagate as fast as the rest of the world because of this. We're going to lose ground just by population shrinking.
Now, my question is this something, once it happens to a person, or is this something that's been passed down over generations through a slow process, or is this something that's happening all at once? And if it is happening all at once, will this kind of information be passed down, if people are able to have kids, to their children? Or is that, we don't know yet how that works?
Well, it's to the male children in particular that we're looking at. I don't know. It depends on what it's causing. If it's a chemistry thing that affects the DNA of the individual, then yes, it could possibly be passed down as a DNA trait. But it's like disappearing the population after a finite amount of time. There won't be anybody left because you won't have enough people, you know, reproduced. Until we find out the major factor in this, I don't know how to answer that question accurately.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of an unfair question. We don't even have hardly any of the information except the statistic about what the sperm counts are. And hopefully they'll be able to further break this down to find out, you know, at least generally what the causes are, whether it is what you said, if it's environment versus if it's our own actions or inactions.
An imperative. It's an imperative written into our DNA code to reproduce, to survive, to be fruitful and multiply, as the Bible says. When people start to have the mental attitude of, oh, we don't need to have children, it's a pain in the neck, you know, we'll have one or two, you know, if we have to, but it's more fun to just, you know, play in life. When that kind of attitude comes across, then the male mind may say, well, okay, I don't need to produce as many sperm because we're not really looking forward to having kids, you know, and it may be a psychological thing as well that is affecting this. I tried to figure out a number of ways that things that might be causing that, and, you know, just like you, I'm puzzled by this.
Interesting. All right, Stan, where do you want to go from here?
Well, an interesting thing that Holly found in her news search yesterday was slide 37, where the LGBT group activists, you know, throw mud at the Christian ministry that has rebuilt the Ark of Noah. They throw mud at them because they're using rainbow lights along the Ark, Noah's Ark, to try to grab back the beautiful thing that the rainbow is, as opposed to it being a symbol for a bunch of quite sinful individuals, you know, in my opinion anyway, in the Bible's opinion. And this article, if you click on that, it'll show you the discussion on it about how the kind of gay community is opposed to this museum, which is built the Noah's Ark, using the rainbow as part of the scriptural thing where God put it in the heavens as a sign to man that he wouldn't destroy the earth by water again. It's a beautiful photo. If you click on it, you can see that it's of a real object, as best they could determine, made to the scale of Noah's Ark. And it's not just, if you go to image 38, you can see it during the daytime without the rainbow lights on it. But it's not just a shell, an ark. This thing has compartments inside of it to hold, a rhinoceros or birds or whatever. And as we discussed, what was it, 2 or 3 weeks ago, Noah didn't have to have every single version of a sparrow, or bird. He had to have the DNA of the general type of animal we're talking about, because from that, you can adaptively mutate that DNA of, say, a bird into all kinds of birds. So he didn't have to have every bird, every tiger, every cat, because cat is, feline, covers lions, tigers, all this kind of stuff. They're cat-like. They all have a basic DNA pattern, which is modified by environment and to become whatever they are. We see this today. So this ark could well have held all of the DNA packages that we need for the major animals of the planet. Now, you go into this museum, there's one up in Cincinnati, I think, that's a sister or brother type museum to this, but if you click on the text there, it takes you to their website, and you can see that they have really developed this thing as a teaching tool to people wanting to know about the truth about Noah's Ark. And you go inside of it, and they've got models of Noah and his wife and doing various things, and they've got cages for various types of animals with animals in there, but they're just like stuffed animals. And I'm a big supporter of this flood concept. As you know, I found Atlantis and I found what caused the flood. So to me, this is just like, wunderbar that someone has done this. And even though I haven't been to this Ark Museum, the Creation Museum, I love it. It's just what a wonderful witness tool it is to show people that it's not myth. I listened to someone on Coast to Coast with Holly last night. No need to bring names into it, but trying to, from a learned point of view, trying to put down a lot of these things as pure myth, not to worry about it. And, from a supposed Christian scientist type person. And it really concerned me that kind of attitude is, being spread out there at the same time as the truth that we have here is. It's just a worry.
Yeah, and those pictures of that replica of Noah's Ark are great. They're fantastic, and
aren't they beautiful?
Something that's interesting that people don't. I wonder if I would say 95% of secular people don't know the story, the biblical story behind the rainbow, and that's why it's been able to be co-opted by the homosexual movement. But it's good to see that it's being taken back by some Christians, whether it's a church or museum. But I think for the most part, people are now, they don't want the stigma that comes along with it. And that is probably what is keeping many from doing that.
And there are those of us that are trying to reverse that trend and kill that stigma. But as hard as we try, the fake news is ignoring it or poo-pooing it. Look at the photo of day on our website. If you go over to standeo.com and look at the photo of the day, it's of a picture we've got hanging on our wall as well. But Holly put that up there to show about the rainbow and some beautiful artwork by Tom Dubois. There you see it. The Dubois family and the Deo family were neighbors when we settled the state of New York in 1645, I think it was. So it is particularly great for us to see one of the Dubois family members paint such a beautiful picture.
That is an awesome picture. Folks, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see what Stan's referring to. And that's, you know, when you think about how far back that was in time, and you almost want to try to envision what it was like. But that's a great image that captures, I think, a lot of what people wonder about.
Yeah, and the other thing is, too, Earthquake, Kim, and I, and a couple of us have been exchanging emails this week about the Yellowstone and the swarm of quakes they had, and then the swarm of quakes up in Montana. And there is an article, which you can link to, that's slide 40, and it does say that there will be a swarm of earthquakes that will precede the eruption at Yellowstone. But it doesn't say that it's going to happen tomorrow, you know, or next week or whatever. It is saying that that is a signal, and we're aware of that. And so watching swarms, people should always pay attention to swarms of earthquakes, whether it be in Southern California, whether it be in Montana, or, you know, Yellowstone or wherever, especially where there's a volcano nearby, because this may be indicative of changes in the magma path underneath the surface of the earth heading up toward the, you know, to the volcanic cone. If you look at things like Yellowstone seismographs, one of the things that tells you magma is moving is you'll see regularly spaced little, like mini earthquakes, you know, like a Richter 1 to 2, and they are like duh, duh, duh. But in between the duhs might be about 7 to 12 minutes. And those are the magma kind of moving up through an old tube, old magma chamber tube, and hanging or catching on the walls as it moves up like rubber over glass. Boom, boom, boom. So that's what you look for in those. I don't see any signs of anything to worry about at this point in time, so I just thought I'd put that up there and, you know, address the giant in the room, but that's what it is. And we'll keep looking for other signals, you know, swarms and things that would tell us that we're expecting either a big earthquake or a volcano. But until we get, you know, positive information on it, I wouldn't get too excited about that. On another issue, down slide 39, you know, we've talked about this a number of times about the Revelation 12, where you have the Virgin and the crown of 12 stars above her head. And I wanted to update the work I've done on that by this image I put in there today, which if you click on it, it'll zoom up to real size. And I went back to August the 15th, 2 BC, because that's when the other time this formation appeared, where we had the nine stars of the Leo constellation above Virgo and three planets, Jupiter and Venus and Mercury, residing in that formation or right around it as part of it, so it could form a crown of 12 stars. And the sun is above her head, as so the Virgin's clothed in the sunlight and the moon is at her feet. But it's not as tight as what we see in this year, the 23rd of September. Now, I don't know whether this formation occurred around the time of the birth of Christ. Certainly, it would be earlier, you know, than, you know, people would think at 0 A.D., that's when he was born. But he was at least 2 years old when the wise men came to him. So by various other methods, you can determine that between 2 and 3 B.C., he was born back there. And this is the date that is close to that. It's about a year and 3.5 months ahead of 0 A.D., if you wish. So between this date here and, you know, 3 B.C., some month in it, November, December, whatever, you might see that's when Christ was actually born. But why it would occur at his birth like this and then now in 2017 is kind of part of the $64 question. Why would it appear again after 2018 years and 3 months or whatever, a year and 3 months?
I got to tell you, Stan, two things I just want to mention, because I got a couple of emails when we talked about this before. There's a difference, folks, between astrology and astronomy, okay? Understand that. Just everyone has got to understand that, okay?
Yeah, look up the definitions for clarification.
So some of the most ignorant comments God created the heavens, put the stars in their places for a reason, so he could tell the
signs and times.
That's right, exactly. So, you know, if you intend to fire off another comment about astrology,
right?
Just save the trouble, because I'm just going to delete it.
I mean,
yeah, don't do it. I mean, look, this is so far from astrology; it's not even funny.
Exactly.
When I was in Israel, I went up to the north, kind of the northeast of it, in the Beit Shean area, and I visited a synagogue that was probably made 300 or 400 AD, somewhere in there. On the floor, with the entire floor of the synagogue and all the seats surrounded it, was a constellation map of the 12 major constellations. Not all this other stuff the astrologers work with. These were in order as they, if you look up in the heavens as we spin around the North Star. They put it in there as an important thing, as messages, or a message full of a lot of sub messages by the names of the stars in these constellations, to mankind as to the progress of mankind on the earth and to the fulfillment of God's plan for mankind. We're now approaching the end of it, where the ends of the start of the 12 signs meets the tail end. And for that reason, the fact that it's in the synagogues, the ancient synagogues, tells me that the message in the stars is correct. There have been a number of scholars for the last 150, 200 years that have addressed the names of the individual stars in these constellations, not only in English, but Arabic, Hebrew. I mean, there are a number of the ancient languages. You pick a star in a constellation and you say, what's the name in, you know, Sumerian, Babylonian, or, you know, Greek or whatever, and you'll find that the name, although it may be different sounding, the meaning of the name of that star is the same. And so the stars within a constellation of the 12 major ones, the star's name tells part of the story that happens in that age of the creation of man and the fulfillment of man that is coming. What I did find interesting in looking at the Virgo formation is that the planet Jupiter was one of the three planets that made the 12 stars in the crown of the Virgin in 2 BC. When you get to now, to our time, the stars that make up the three extra ones in the constellation of Leo are Mercury, Mars, and Venus. Where's Jupiter? Jupiter's now down at kind of mid-thigh of the Virgin. And I talked with a woman, one of your listeners, by email, about the meaning of that star Heza, which I did have an article about down in slide 24 and 20, and she said, you know, that it's like the return of the Messiah, you know, to vanquish his enemies. So this formation in our time, the message may well indicate Jupiter, the ruling king thing, may be the return of the king to dispose of his enemy, you know, which is Satan, his minion. Anyway, how would people of all these different cultures look up at the stars at night and say, oh, there's the shape of a man, there's the shape of an urn? Someone taught them this. All the older cultures had the model taught to them so that it would not go away, so that man could not pervert what the message of the stars was. You know, it's a message from God written up there that you won't see unless someone tells you. You know, these three stars are in Orion's belt, which is the belt around, you know. You see what I'm saying? These things don't leap at you if you look up at the stars. They were planned.
Yeah, and you know, I still, it's a fascinating topic of discussion. And one thing that, when you were just saying that, Stan, that especially about Orion, that came to mind, is sometimes I'll find myself watching that Ancient Alien show, just because I like to see how much of the Bible they throw in there. Then they all attribute everything to extraterrestrials. But this is one I watched maybe a few days or weeks ago. It was about, you know, the pyramids from Egypt to Mexico to places across the world that, you know, had these setups that all aligned with the Orion's belt. And that's one of the arguments they made, that, you know, how is it that civilizations thousands of miles away, hundreds and thousands of years ago, have the same, you know, astrological or the setup with the way that they aligned their buildings, their pyramids, and different things. So there is something to what you're saying, at least as far as knowledge being passed down or shared, I believe.
Yeah, you know, some of these cultures, I do watch the same show for the same reason you do, but some of these cultures, pointing to Orion as the place that God came from, or the gods, demigods or whatever, they looked up or were taught that that's where they came from. But some of the cultures say, no, they came from the Milky Way, which is not part of the Orion's belt. But anyway, they're all saying up and out there. And I do watch how they pervert the truth of the Bible in that History Channel. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. They do it constantly. I mean, they'll take, you know, 10 points, 10 out of 10 points from the Bible, and then just make the leap, no matter what it is they're talking about, of,
oh,
what if it wasn't
the same,
you know,
thing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I watch it for the entertainment value. I mean, they do a good job in putting stuff together and whatnot, but it's just ridiculous how they attribute everything to aliens and how they're so dogmatic about not believing the Bible, but taking everything in the Bible and using it to make their arguments about aliens.
Good point. Really a good point.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Stan, we've reached the end of the show already. We got about a minute left. So, the image that you were just talking about, the sign in the sky, I know a lot of people are keeping their eye on that, and we'll probably have to talk about this more as we get closer to this date. So just something to... there's a lot of interest, I guess is what I'm saying, in this topic.
Well, I'll do some more research on it, as others are doing, I'm standing on the shoulders of other people that have already figured this out and brought it to our attention. In slide 43, just quickly, just for fun later, if you click on that.
All right.
Where is that? Let me just get to that website thing there. Slide 43. What do you see?
I see a bunch of different pictures of some drawings. You holding a... it looks like a replica of the drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little explanation there.
Yeah.
People wonder what I've been doing in my spare time, hey? This is it. And it dates back to an image from 1890, a British test of a new kind of cannon shell. And from that...
Really?
Yeah, and it would go a long way, much longer than a normal ball-shaped thing. And if you look closely at this is the secret of what I started with, and that's why I got recruited to go to Teller's Project. And then I started using it, adapting it to water and air. And eventually I saw that NASA's forecast for warp drives follows the same technique I'm using here. In essence, it says you push fuel or exhaust or whatever you want to call it, the field, you push it ahead of your craft, and it actually drags you behind it, drags you forward, lowering the resistance. So you can go many times the speed of light, believe it or not, but that will come out. And this is just to show you folks that I don't kind of sit around here daydreaming. I do actually do things.
Well, that's fascinating, Stan. We are absolutely out of time. We'll have to get into this a little bit next week. But thank you so much.
Wow.
And until then, stay safe. God bless. And tell Holly we said hello. And you have a great week.
I'll do her. Thank you. Lord bless you now.
Good night.
All right, that'll do it for us. Until tomorrow, stay safe, God bless, have a great night.